This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about New Orleans and the efforts by community activists to demand justice there in the period post-Katrina. With me to talk about this is Jordan Flaherty, the leading left-wing journalist in New Orleans who's chronicled the struggle there for years now. He's got a new book out, really great book, entitled Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Gina Six. Jordan Flaherty, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt. It's really a pleasure. I'm a great admirer of your work.
Well, I've been following your dispatches from New Orleans ever since Katrina, and just amazing journalism and activism that you've been doing down there. How'd you get to New Orleans in the first place?
I moved to New Orleans a few years before Hurricane Katrina, and when I first got there, I was working as a community organizer. And Hurricane Katrina was a big change for me. I just was in the city when the hurricane hit and wrote about what I had seen, which was people being evacuated through an evacuee camp with soldiers pointing guns at them, families being separated. I get out of the city and I see the media coverage depicting people as criminals, looters, gangs. And so I wrote about what I saw, and community organizers in the city that I respected and some other folks nationally encouraged me to start writing about what I'd seen and what was happening in New Orleans. So, I came to New Orleans as an organizer, but my process of living there changed me into a journalist.
Huh. And you write in this book, Floodlines, Jordan Flaherty, about deciding to stay in New Orleans even as you were getting the alerts that the whole country was getting that this huge monster storm was coming. Why'd you decide to stay?
I'm from Miami originally, so we have hurricanes pretty regularly. We had just had, I believe it was Hurricane Ivan a year before Hurricane Katrina, where the same warnings went out and everyone evacuated, and then it didn't even rain in New Orleans. We didn't think it was going to be that level of a storm. And a lot of the people that did leave just left in those hours right before, where it suddenly seemed like this really is going to come to the city. And I certainly had more privilege and more access than a lot of other people, but I still did not have a car. It was not easy for me to evacuate. And I was also, I think, realistic about what hurricanes mean. These disasters, hurricanes, earthquakes, certainly a range of people die, but it is primarily people that have less money, people that are on lower ground, people that are in less sturdy houses, people who have illnesses. And I knew it as a young person in a sturdy home in a sturdy part of town that I had levels of privilege and that I would be safe.
What did you witness?
In those first hours, we thought that we were okay. We kept saying we dodged the bullet again. We went out and there was some water on the ground, but there's always water on the ground after a storm in New Orleans. And there wasn't any major damage and we thought everything's okay. And then over the next day, the water, instead of going down, started rising. We started hearing rumors that there had been a break in the levee, but we also heard about sandbags being dropped in. So we just thought it was, again, something that would be fixed in a few hours. And the next day we woke up and the water was higher, and that's when we started getting worried. But still, we really had no idea how bad it was. I was in the mid-city neighborhood of New Orleans, not one of the hardest hit areas, and very far from the Lower Ninth Ward or Lakeview or even Gentilly, where some of the worst damage was, where houses were knocked over by the water rushing in after the levees broke. But what really sticks with me was after I finally did evacuate several days later, and going to this evacuee camp outside of town, seeing hundreds, even thousands of people, mostly African American, mostly working class, and seeing how people were being treated, that there was no facilities available for people, as I mentioned a minute ago, that these buses would stop and they would stop at a different place every time. People wouldn't be told where the bus was going. You weren't told until you got on if it was going to Houston or Baton Rouge or Arkansas or Oklahoma. And I saw families get separated. It was really painful to me to see that.
Yeah, you say that experience in that camp, which lasted for you just a day or so, right, changed your life. How did it change your life?
I mean, I was very fortunate. Even lasted a few hours for me. Again, with my layers of privilege, after a number of hours, I actually hitchhiked a ride with a Australian TV crew and got out of there. It changed my life because, you know, I'm cynical about the government of this country and about the way this government behaves, but even I just did not expect to see people in the U.S. treated that way. I know how this government often functions overseas, but to see people being treated that way, and I just am absolutely convinced that people would not be treated that way if this were on Martha's Vineyard or on any of countless other communities in this country. I absolutely believe that this disaster was really shaped by race in so many ways.
Yeah. You know, the racism just smacks you in the head when you read this book, Floodlines. I'm speaking with Jordan Flaherty. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at the Progressive Magazine. For me, one of the anecdotes about racism that is just inescapable is while you were still in that building on that roof in New Orleans, and one of the community organizers came up with the idea, because the helicopters kept bypassing everybody, well, let's get all the black people off the roof and just leave white people on the roof. Then what happened?
Then suddenly, very quickly after, help arrived. A helicopter came and dropped off supplies and said they're going to start helping people evacuate. So straightforward. And there's so many stories of people at the convention center on rooftops that, you know, saw this. These official vehicles go by, no one stopping, no one offering any help. And there was even a story that Lance Hill, a professor at Tulane, has documented at one of the hotels, where literally the mostly white guests were separated from the mostly black staff and evacuated in two different directions. The white guests were given a bus out of town to safety, and the black folks, mostly black staff, were given a bus to the Superdome.
Yeah, those stories are just shocking to me. And of course, what came out later, and I don't know when you heard first about this, I'm interested in your answer about the police murders of black people just who were, you know, trying to get from one place or another or just on the bridge. How'd you start hearing about that?
You know, people started talking about just days after Hurricane Katrina, which is why, and I'm sure we'll talk about this later, why it's so painful that our local media took so long to get the story. I have a friend who's an investigator, meaning she works for defense attorneys to help investigate for their clients. And she told me about this case of Danziger Bridge of police shooting just a few weeks after the storm. I remember also, you know, I first heard about the police, the Gretna police that were stationed on the Crescent City Connection, the bridge across the Mississippi River, that fired shots over people's heads to keep them from crossing, from evacuating out of the city. And again, I'm cynical, but I really did not believe that story. I said that can't be true. And of course, now it is true. And actually just, I believe in the last week or so, it just happened that a judge ruled that those people can't go forward with a lawsuit, that they have no grounds for a lawsuit on that case. I mean, it's incredible. You know, we talk about these, famous civil rights marches disrupted. I mean, this is not a march for justice. These are people that needed to evacuate and were literally kept out by police. And the fact, I mean, this should have been the front page.
I mean, I found it hard to believe too, but then, you know, I'm asking myself, as, you know, middle, upper class white guy, maybe that's why I found it hard to believe. And if I were a black guy who lived in L.A. or in New Orleans or in Philly or in Chicago, maybe it would have been pretty easy to believe. And you say the local media was so slow to get on the story. I know there was a great freelancer, A.C. Thompson, who did a lot of the great work in exposing this. Why was the corporate media so slow, or the New Orleans media so slow?
It's a good question. I hope that they're asking themselves that question now. This is, after 3 years, A.C. Thompson's story was published. You know, for that 3-plus-year period, there was very little in the local media about these stories of police violence after Hurricane Katrina. It was really the story that nobody wanted to explore. Now, it's become the story that everybody knows, and actually the Daily Paper has done a good job on it post A.C. Thompson's stories. But he really broke it open and did the investigating that no one in our local media was willing to do.
Yeah, shameful. I'm speaking with Jordan Flaherty. He's the author of Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Gina 6. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at The Progressive Magazine, and you're listening to Progressive Radio. Another thing in the mainstream media at the time, there were all these rumors about terrible crimes going on either at the Dome or all over New Orleans. And you point out in your book, Jordan Flaherty, that there were a lot of young black men who were actually the first responders in New Orleans. That's a story I hadn't heard.
Yeah, and those stories keep coming out, especially anyone that lived near the housing projects or in many of the poor and African-American communities, for example. A woman named Mama D, who's a civil rights activist, worked with a group called the Soul Patrol, a group of mostly younger black men from the 7th Ward neighborhood of New Orleans who were going out rescuing people, bringing people supplies. There was also a group in the St. Bernard housing development, again, mostly young black men who, by some stories, they did break into stores, but got food and water and brought it to people who had none and who were trapped in their homes. They went around by boat rescuing people. It's a brilliant team of photographers in the lower Ninth Ward, Keith Calhoun and Chandra McCormick, who have documented stories, and they did a series called The Real First Responders of Hurricane Katrina, where they documented, again, mostly poor working class black men from the lower Ninth Ward that were out in boats for days rescuing people while no other help seemed to arrive.
And why didn't more help arrive?
You know, Bush advisor Grover Norquist said, "We want to make government so small that you can drown it in a bathtub." And this is a project that's been going on for decades. And I think they were really effective. They made government not reliable on every level. And I think that, you know, we see it in public housing, where public housing in the 30s and up through the 60s with the Johnson's programs, the public housing was great craftsmen in most cities, very well built, well maintained. And then this conservative attack, you know, destroyed the infrastructure of public housing. And then we were suddenly forced with a choice in around the country of, do you want to hold on to this public housing that's in terrible shape, or do you want to demolish it? And it's this terrible choice. You know, healthcare, again, we've been given this image that the government can't provide healthcare because the government's incompetent. It's been a multi-decade project to make the government incompetent.
And you talk in your book, Jordan Flaherty, about this public housing dilemma and how excruciating it was for activists in New Orleans to have the city council unanimously vote to tear down that public housing, even though the public housing was flawed. But the choice, you say, for many of the people in that public housing was flawed public housing or homelessness. And so how involved were you in that, and how have people responded who got evicted?
You know, the amount of people that are homeless in New Orleans, it's staggering. It's 12,000 people by some estimates. Some say more, some say less, but that's from Unity Greater New Orleans coalition that works on homelessness. 12,000 people out of a population of, at best, about 360,000. So that's about 3% of the population of the city. You know, so for any of your listeners, imagine if 3% of the population of your city is homeless. You know, that would be, in New York City, I believe that would be, what, about 300,000, give or take 200,000. I'm not sure the exact population, but that a massive amount of people. People are living in flood damaged homes. It was so painful to see the way the many forces lined up on this fight of public housing. We had city, state, federal government, and these foundations, and other wealthy developers. For example, billionaire Warren Buffett was one of the main financing behind the redevelopment of the St. Bernard, former public housing development. So these places that have been torn down had so many enemies. But I do want to say, because this is not all hopelessness, that there was incredible organizing and incredible resistance that happened on all these issues. A broad coalition that was brought together of public housing residents at the center and really leading the fight, joined by activists, civil rights attorneys, folks like Bill Quigley and Tracy Washington.